Psychotherapy has never been static. It has evolved through waves of theory and practice over the years, and beneath all the models, it lies a deeper question. What actually makes therapy work? This week, on the Making Therapy Better podcast, our host, Dr. Bruce Wampold, is actually our guest. Bruce joins a group of young psychologists from Brazil, composed by me, Jace Araújo, Maurício Majolo, Matheus Souza, and Lucas Cardoso, to talk about the past, the present, and the future of psychotherapy. We talk about the factors that drive change, the tension between psychotherapy models and the evidence available, and also the challenges that we face as therapists. Bruce reminds us that psychotherapy is not a set of techniques and is definitely not a manual that we should follow through. It is actually a very powerful social healing practice. We really hope that you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. And don't forget to like and subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment. We would love to hear from you. Okay, so it's a great pleasure to be sitting today with one of the most important psychologists and psychotherapies researchers in the world, one of the authors of The Great Psychotherapy Debate, and this great scholar that has been transforming the field of psychotherapy over the years, Dr. Bruce Wampold. Thank you so much, Bruce, for coming today and have this great conversation with us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to talk about important issues in psychotherapy and to have the opportunity to present my perspective. So, it's not the predominant perspective, but I think it has the opportunity to really improve the field in ways that other perspectives do not. So I'm eager to give my opinion and my judgment about psychotherapy.
Great. We're super excited to have you today. And so it's just to give a little bit of context to the audience. We are a group of psychologists from Brazil, and we have been deeply impacted by your work in different ways. We have different backgrounds, different experiences, and right now, we are facing a very challenging time in Brazil regarding to psychotherapy, especially when we talk about evidence-based practices or evidence-based approaches. And with that, we decided to reach out to you to be able to have this conversation to talk about the past, the present, and the future of psychotherapy. And maybe some people that are listening and watching us, they know about your work, maybe they don't. So I would like to start to just ask a little bit about you and how you became interested in psychology and psychotherapies, because we know that you were trained as a mathematician. So how was that? Like, how did you get into psychotherapy and psychology?
Yeah. Well, as an undergraduate in the United States, I was a mathematics and economics major, and I never took a psychology course. So in a way, I'm a psychologist without a degree in psychology, at least an undergraduate degree in psychology, which I think is interesting because it gives you a different perspective. I mean, I'm trained in the sciences rather than in social sciences. So it's more of a perspective that is evidence-based, which is a term we throw around, but it has an imprecise meaning. But anyway, after I finished my degree, it was in the early 1970s, much unrest in the United States around the Vietnam War. My generation was kind of down with the establishment. Don't take a traditional job. I spent a summer as a insurance actuarial trainee and thought that that conventional life is not for me. But I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So I said, well, I'll get my certificate to teach school, and I'll teach math and science. So I started out in what we call junior high school, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, in a little small rural town in a logging community. But when I was there, there was a teacher who had taught all over the world, and he suggested I go to Hawaii and teach one of the private schools, which there are several. So I ended up teaching at Punahou School, which is a private school, but with many scholarship kids. One of the scholarship kids when I was there was this kid named Barry, Barry Obama. So I didn't have him in class, but I knew Barry. But I got interested in the kid, the students and their development. It was so interesting to me. And I became more interested in them and their development intellectually, cognitively, but also emotionally, and to see a variety of cultural groups, because Hawaii is a very diverse cultural area. A lot of kids from Samoa, Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans. It was a fabulous place to get interested in psychology. So I did a master's degree at the University of Hawaii, which in the United States is not sufficient really to be a psychologist. So I decided, well, I'm going to do this. So I entered a PhD program, which is in the United States, a scientist practitioner, where you learn both research and practice at University of California, Santa Barbara, which, JC, you're there presently, beautiful place. But when I was studying there, I realized that to impact what was happening in people's lives, the research track was a way to do that. You're producing the research and theory to guide the field. So that was pretty exciting for me. I had the background in mathematics, so statistics and all the methods were accessible to me in a very sophisticated way. And so that's kind of the part where I got interested in psychology, mental health systems. But then, you know, there's a kind of a personal part as well. Part of it is my personality. I don't like to go along with the crowd, especially if I don't think they're going in the right direction. So there's a little anti-authoritarianism in my personality. And so when I was told, you know, cognitive behavioral treatment is the best treatment, this is what you need to do, I said, show me the proof. And when I started delving into it, I really saw the evidence for the superiority of CBT just wasn't there. So, and then the final part of this is that, you know, when I grew up, my mother died when I was very young. Lots of consequences of that. I won't tell the whole story because we don't have time. But it really affected my development, my relationships. So I went to therapy. And after a couple unsuccessful therapies due to my engagement and willingness to face some issues, I finally had a therapist who engaged me in the treatment, not CBT, not behavioral, but more psychodynamic and exploratory. And I finally got a chance to discuss the issue of my mother's death and the grief that I never was allowed to express and so forth. So this idea that we should be able to choose the therapy that is best for us, fits the issue, fits our personality, our way we want to work. And so to limit access to therapies that work for many people really angered me. So there was a scientific kind of aspect to this and a very personal aspect.
Yeah. I was just wondering, Bruce, if during your experience in psychotherapy, especially when you found someone that was really helpful to you, like if you would point out what in that relationship helped you?
Well, my therapist, his name was Bernie, so I'll use that name. I remember the day when Bernie said to me, when I was kind of talking about superficial issues, and he said, "Bruce, I don't get why you come here every week, because you're really not talking about what's important to you." And it was that challenge that somebody was direct and honest about my bullshit. That changed. That was the defining instance. And I said, "Well, Bernie, I guess I'm going to really tell you why I'm here." And it was hard. There's a lot of, you know, I'm kind of making the simple version, but there was a lot of stuff to deal with. And I trusted that Bernie not only had a good relationship with me, but would be able to help me. So it's not just trust that this is empathic understanding, but that he had the ability, the skills, and the approach that would actually be helpful, because nobody wants to do the work. And psychotherapy can be very painful and a lot of work unless we're confident it's going to be helpful. Okay. And that's the day I decided, yeah, I better do it.
That's beautiful. And I think that leads us to an important question that we were discussing previously, which is about common factors. Maybe Majolov?
Right. So it is to hearing about your motivations and personal engagement with the issues of psychotherapy, because I think that many times during our training and studies, we try to grasp some certainties or answers about how to provide the best service, or why is it working for some people and not for other. And I've been telling people that I am an existential and humanistic psychotherapist. So I deeply believe in the idea that there are aspects crucial to the relationship and to the characteristics of the psychotherapist, which are very in line with the debate about common factors versus specific ingredients or specific factors. So it's very important to me to ask you a question about this central theme on your research that was very impactful for me. So the idea of common factors can often evoke some mistaken notion of conflict. as if they were of conflict, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As if they were competing with the specific ingredients of therapy. We see this all the time when talking about common factors in Brazil. There is this notion that common factors would be, to defend common factors would be something like anything goes. You are telling that anything goes on psychotherapy.
Yeah.
And as if engaging common factors in therapy was a passive ability, a passive characteristic of psychotherapy, synonymous to non-directivity or elements that don't require engagement. So I would like to ask you, how would you define common factors? How would you dismantle this maybe untrue notion of conflict? What are their implications for clinical practice? If you could talk a bit about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting, and there's a lot to unpack in your question. So maybe this will be the final question, and I'll just go on for the hour. But there's much misunderstanding about the common factors. Those people who criticize this perspective don't really understand what the factors are. Now, we say common factors because it goes back to Saul Reisenvig in 1936, I believe, where he said the commonalities are what makes therapy work. I like therapeutic factors better than common factors, because therapeutic factors really says this is what makes therapy work. Well, if you read Jerome Frank's seminal work, Persuasion and Healing, one of the common factors is a coherent, believable treatment to which the therapist and the patient believe will be helpful to reach their goals. So one of the common factors is having a treatment that's coherent. It is clear that if you do the work of therapy, there's a good chance you will get better. And so Frank talked about the myth and the ritual. You need a myth, an explanation. And by the way, most explanations given by treatments aren't really true. They're naive hypotheses about psychopathology and how you overcome difficulty. There's very little evidence that CBT works through the modification of cognitions, and that cognitions are the critical aspect to change and to lead to distress. So, but you need that. Explanation about how and why you're suffering, and then a method to overcome it. Okay, so one of the common factors or therapeutic factors is a coherent, believable treatment that, if the patient does the hard work, will lead to achieving goals or progress towards those goals. Anyway, so we have to remember that part. Okay, now you have the treatment, whether it's CBT or psychodynamic or humanistic. It has to be delivered in an effective way. And the effective way is usually the relationship variables. So if you look at the evidence, and I think this is overwhelmingly clear, there are very few, if any, differences among treatments for any disorders. Maybe the exception is a simple phobia, or maybe OCD. But other than that, we don't have any convincing evidence that one treatment is superior to another. Okay, many meta-analyses, some by myself and my group, but Pim Kuypers, who's a kind of defender of CBT, has done more meta-analyses than you can count or read in a lifetime, has found no differences. Just published a major article. All the treatments for depression achieve comparable outcomes. However, within each of those therapies, the success of the therapist varies widely. There are some tremendously effective CBT therapists, okay, and there are some really poor ones. But the same is true for psychodynamic, humanistic, whatever you look, ACT. So there's variability in the effectiveness based on the therapist. It's us who makes a difference. It was Bernie that made a difference for me. Okay. So I could have been to another similar therapist and not achieved what I did because of differences in the therapist. So there's really, I think, two kind of suboptimal ways to do therapy. One is, okay, you go to school, you learn CBT manuals, you know how to deliver the treatment. So there's an over-reliance on the method and very little attention to the other aspects, the relationship, the understanding, the caring, the communication of hope. So that's CBT. And there's a lot of, particularly, I think there's a trend to teach manuals rather than teach therapy. Now, on the other side, there's some therapists who have no treatment protocol. You just go and talk. My pet peeve is the therapist said, well, how was your week? Okay, and you tell some stories to somebody who's understanding and compassionate, empathic, and so forth. By the way, the research shows that works, but not as well as it could. But there's no hard work towards goals. There's nothing you're learning new. So there has to be both this really important relationship, which we can go into because there's a lot of nuances about what are the aspects of the relationship that makes it effective. But you have to have that relationship and a method, maybe method's not the right word, but a protocol for that patient to overcome difficulties. And it involves hard work. You know, it might be CBT, you learn, change your core schema, address some of your maladaptive thoughts. Interpersonal therapy, you might learn how to form relationships in a more constructive and rewarding way. Psychodynamic therapy, learn about your avoided affects and how your defenses have cut you off from various opportunities in life. So in all of these treatments, you learn something. It just doesn't seem to be too important exactly what you learn. We know that achieving goals in one area generalizes to other areas. So complex question, but yeah, you need a treatment. A treatment is, in a sense, a common factor, but it has to be delivered in an optimal way to make it most effective. So either over-reliance or slavish adherence to a treatment manual, hey, we're in session three. We have these tasks we have to do at session three. And there are people that do that. Is suboptimal. But also being warm, caring, compassionate, empathic, you need a treatment How are we going to work? How is the patient going to work towards their goals? So both of those things, and it's the therapist that makes a difference.
And I think that is so important, Bruce, what you're pointing out, because in my own experience, when I was studying, training to be a psychologist, there was this big discussion about how the therapists show up in the room and the techniques that, as an existential psychologist, people were really like debating that we should not use techniques in existential therapy, and that, and being warm and empathetic and present, and that would be sufficient. And I was really looking outside the box of what were being presented to me, because I don't think that only these interpersonal skills, this is not sufficient. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. We also need, as you said, to have a plan, the treatment goals. And I think that is super important for us, especially in Brazil right now, to understand and think how can we bring together these two aspects of psychotherapy in our clinical practice.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, if we could take the best of both approaches and combine them, we'd be doing a great service. We waste so much time in our field arguing over what's the best treatment. You know, there's 10 or 15,000 clinical trials of different psychotherapies. It's a tremendous waste of money. If we could spend some of that effort studying what makes an effective therapist, for instance, and how to train more effective therapists, we'd be much better off.
Professor, you talked about those myths and rituals, and this is a thing for me, because I think this connect the psychotherapy with a more sociological approach, because you have a community sharing a myth and working on a ritual to achieve some results. Could you talk a little bit more about this and the importance of sharing the myth and some rituals to achieve the result?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the important predictors of outcome of psychotherapy is the acceptance of the explanation and the treatment. Do I believe, you know, what my therapist is telling me about why I'm depressed and how I'm going to work to overcome those feelings of depression? Is absolutely critical. But it's up to the therapist to, in a sense, persuade the patient that this is a good way to work. Well, you can't say before the therapy starts, treatment X is the treatment I like to give. It's got evidence for it. I've been successful for it. Patient comes in and says, well, I'm depressed. We explore a little bit of it. And then you say, well, over here, I've got treatment X, and this is going to be the best treatment for you. Because you have to know the patient. You have to know the cultural background, the beliefs about mental health. So one of the first things I ask a patient is, so why do you think you're depressed? Okay. So give me your, and this has been referred to in the literature as folk psychology. This is the some of it's cultural, some of it's idiosyncratic, some of it you learn from your family, some you just make up. Okay. I had an engineer, very depressed, and he was I had a patient, and he was an engineer. So, okay, well, why do you think you're depressed? He said, do you have a graph paper? And I didn't have graph paper, but I had a notebook. I handed to him. He starts drawing a graph, and he explained it to me in terms of systems theory. He was a systems engineer. And I go, this is a very clever fellow, but he wants a precise explanation of how this is going to work. Okay, there's not going to be any exploration of kind of the psyche. So, modified CBT. And I explained how it worked and how it was going to be helpful to him in his particular situation. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. So if I'd done something else, it wouldn't have been a success. So you have to know the patient, culture, background, beliefs, and all of this stuff to design the treatment in a way that really is believable to this particular patient. And you watch good therapists explain what they're going to do in therapy. And by the way, that's a critical skill and one that takes a lot of practice to do. Many therapists never explain why we're doing what we do in therapy and how it's going to be useful. I come every week. I do what you ask. But if someone were to say to me, a friend, what's the basis of your therapy? What do you do in therapy and how is this going to be helpful? And you kind of go, I don't know. I just go every week and there's something interesting to talk about. We talk about some difficult stuff, but I don't know how that's helpful. That's a problem. They should be able to say, you know, well, I have these way of looking at the world, my fundamental attributions that just lead to depression. And I need to systematically change that schema. Or I'm avoiding the sadness about the fact that my son lives with his mother and she's not a competent caretaker. And I've been avoiding that feeling because it's just too overwhelming and I'm kind of a macho guy and sadness isn't what I do. So we do different things, but they have to do the one that's going to be useful for this particular patient.
I really love this, because this is a call for therapists to become like something like an anthropologist that goes around the world and around people with extremely curiosity, because you have to tune with your patient and then you have to find something that is common and familiar, and this is really good. Do you think that?
Well, two things. One is you hit on one of the characteristics of effective therapists, and that is curiosity. Okay. Curious about this patient's life and willingness to be open to understanding. Too many therapists, one session, I know what's wrong with you and I know how to fix you. Okay. That's bad. Okay. You know, I didn't quite address this idea of sociology and anthropology is good, because I really like both of those fields as important to becoming an effective therapist. But you have to understand the context in which people live. I mean, we know about systems theory. We don't have to be a systemic therapist. But I think you have to think about the context in which people live. I mean, we know economic resources, education, family relations all make a big difference in response to therapy. And we have to be exquisitely aware of that. By the way, this is a great conversation because we're talking about both the science of psychotherapy and the practice. And so, you know, you hear
people. which is necessary for us, because it's not, sometimes I feel that we rely way too much in what clinical trials are showing us and trying to perform the same thing that the clinical trials did in a lab or in a specific context, which is not ideal to our clinical practice, because we have different environment, different context, a different person. And as I think was in the Scott Miller episode that we have in the Making Therapy Better podcast, you guys are talking about, like, usually the clients that we have in our clinical practice is, they are messier than the participants in clinical trials. So talking about research and knowing about research is necessary, but we really need to be thinking about what is possible and how to adapt that to the reality of our patients, the reality of our clients, in a way that makes sense. Yeah. And in communicating that in a language that they can understand too. And for me, I saw a very significant difference in the way that my clients respond to therapy when I came across your work, and I changed the way I was doing therapy, because I had some intuition as I was questioning some aspects of my own practice. And then by studying and changing the way, especially bringing, talking about the treatment plan and talking about especially the treatment plan, actually, and the goals, that really changed the way that we together approached any therapeutic benefit out of our process. So, yeah.
You know, we talk about culturally adapted therapy in the United States, but good therapy is always adapted. You know, no two patients, even if their disorder is formally the same, are the same at all. So again, it's the curiosity, but it's also this idea that every patient is a challenge to figure out how to approach this in the most effective way.
Yeah, it's also being open to the unknown, because we don't know what's going to show up. We don't know how he's going to, the client's going to respond to our interventions. We don't know. So being open to the unknown with curiosity, I think it's really, really necessary.
Well, Bruce, the next question we thought to make here, well, you answered a little bit before, but I think we can maybe look a little deeper, I think. Today in Brazil, to give you a context, we're facing intense debates, right? So these debates, maybe they have an idea of what really works in psychotherapy. So there's an idea that empirically supported treatments, sometimes we can say they being called as the gold standards for some disorders. There is this idea that they should be prioritized for specific disorders, such as behavior activation for depression or PE for PTSD and a lot of other models. So what we think is that this often generates confusion about the effectiveness of therapy and even the validity of less popular therapies, such some traditions which are not mainstream or something like that. And the scenario brings to our mind your critics on the two volumes of the Great Psychotherapy Debate, and even the creation and of the evidence-based practice policy of APA. And we wonder, in your opinion, how can we address this prescriptive and standardized approach to therapy, especially in therapist training? So how should we train, and how should we deal with this?
Well, this is a challenging question, because, you know, we have the the same debates here, the same kind of powerful people who want to promote a particular therapy. You know, the history of the evidence-based treatment or empirically supported, whatever you want to call it, is quite interesting, because in the United States, it actually was an effort to get psychotherapy, which they no longer call psychotherapy. It's psychological treatments. So you don't do psychotherapy, you deliver a psychological treatment to be accepted in the healthcare system. So psychologists would get paid in the same mechanism that physicians got paid. To do that, you have to do what medicine does, and that is say, here are proven treatments for particular disorders. Okay. So in a sense, that movement promoted psychology and the careers of psychologists. It made psychotherapy, or the delivery of psychological treatments, available to a lot of people because they have health insurance. Health insurance doesn't pay for enough, but it pays for psychotherapy. You know, before that movement, you had to pay for psychotherapy out of your pocket, and it was expensive. Only rich people could afford to go to psychotherapy. So that movement really promoted the field. But it was a deal with the devil in some ways, because we got this idea that what's important is this treatment. So there has to be some recognition that is really not the approach. This is a social healing practice, what we're doing. I mean, you think about it, it's pretty absurd that you can go sit with a therapist for 50 minutes a week, right, and talk. Okay, you might do some things too, but talk is the essence of this, and is as effective as medications for non-psychotic disorders. Okay, we can talk about treatment for psychosis if you want to, but let's talk about non-psychotic disorders, where it's very clear psychotherapy is as effective without the side effects, longer lasting, and so forth, just based on talking for 50 minutes in the kind of modal model. That's a social healing practice. And it's not because you follow some manual, that here's the manual and you do it the way it says. That's not the essence of psychotherapy. And when we made this pact where we were going to offer psychological treatments of proven efficacy, we lost the emphasis on what really makes psychotherapy effective. And that's a shame, because many therapists being trained today know manuals, but they don't know how to do psychotherapy. Sorry to say.
How do you see, based on that, Bruce, how do you see a possible future where therapists could know better how to do psychotherapy? Because as you pointed, the context that the manualized treatment, the context is important and was important in the history of the development of these kind of treatments. And now that we know what makes therapy effective,
well, we don't know exactly. We're still working on it.
we're still working it.
We know
better. We know more than we knew like 20 years ago. And how, so I'm curious to hear, like, how do you see the future of the field, or how can we actively be engaged in a change in order to promote better training for psychotherapists?
Well, that's a hard one to kind of predict the future. I mean, I've taken as my role to produce the science that supports the perspective of what makes psychotherapy work, things we've been talking about. Others are more publicly engaged. Scott Miller, for instance, is quite dynamic and in a way subversive, because all over the world he trains therapists to pay attention to their outcomes and to improve through deliberate practice. So, you know, I think what we have to do is keep influencing the professional organizations, the health systems, and individual training programs and therapists. I mean, I wouldn't say all is lost. In fact, there's a resurgence of the relationship as an important variable in CBT. Okay, I just wrote a chapter for a book on the relationships in cognitive behavioral therapy. And, well, they're getting it slowly, but it's a big, big change for how they were trained and what they believe. But I think, you know, it ebbs and flows, but let's keep up the fight. I'm going to keep writing papers, trying to influence how people think. And, you know, Scott, as well as many others who I think get this.
And Bruce, I think other than doing the science part of it, which is very important, and you have been doing this outstanding work over the years, there is also another aspect of your work, which is the science communication. And sometimes researchers, they don't have the skill to communicate what science and papers are communicating to us. And I see that maybe one way of also influence people in the field is to do more of science communication, as you have been doing with the podcast and the workshops that you have been promoting. And I also want to hear a little bit about like your perspective on how the field is changing in terms of communicating the research findings in a better way, in a way that not only therapists can understand, but also clients. How do you see this?
Yeah, well, I mean, we know social media and electronic communications are extremely important. And I think we have to be active in that realm. You know, JC, you know, we have a podcast series which is mostly talking to scientists and clinicians about what they do, and I think that's really important. But we need to reach out directly to patients and tell them what good therapy is. You know, patients go to therapy, and often they don't know what happens in therapy. What makes good therapy? What do you do if you feel like your therapist is not effective? How do you have a discussion about your progress? We haven't talked about measurement-based care as an alternative to evidence-based treatments, but it's an important one. So, as you know, we're starting to think about how can we talk directly to patients so patients knows what's good therapy and what to do if your therapy is not as effective as it could be. You know, when I give workshops on therapist effects, I always start by saying, you know, therapist effects. There have been, 10 or 15,000 clinical trials of different psychotherapies. There have been maybe 20 studies of therapists, right? Amazing, isn't it? When you think about the money spent. But I begin the workshops by saying, every therapist knows some are better than others, right? Every patient knows some therapists are better than others. Why is it in the science we don't study therapists? You know, I try to get money from our National Institute of Mental Health to study therapists. And basically they said, sorry, we study treatments. And where's your manual? Because I was going to treatment as usual, and I was going to help those therapists improve their outcomes as opposed to teaching them manuals. But where's your manual for your treatment?
I think that this is such an interesting topic because we so often see people on social media giving their personal experiences about doing psychotherapy, like my therapist made this, or he said that, or she did not answer my question. Is that normal? Should I change my therapist? And I think that first place, what you're doing with making therapy better and with your research program decades ago, it's very, very important because it defies the challenges, the idea that therapy should work like a kind of a scalpel incision to remove mental suffering from the person, and it's not like that,
right?
It definitely does not work like that. We all know that, even those that sell courses or try to study as if it were like that. We all know, practitioners know, researchers know that it can't feasibly be thought about in that way. But nonetheless, we continue feeding this discourse, this medical discourse. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is like the main aspect of the, in my opinion, the main aspect of the whole debate that should be we should move beyond the idea that psychotherapy or psychological treatments are like that, like removal of suffering.
Yeah, there's some discrete psychopathology that I can identify and either change or, as you say, remove it like a inflamed appendix. But, you know, we touched briefly on this idea about measurement-based care. Isn't it amazing that places around the world are mandating you do particular treatments, and it's usually CBT? We don't really care how the therapist delivers the CBT, and whether it works. So why don't we assess the benefits of therapists and help therapists improve? You know, a study we did of therapists is that over the course of their career, they don't improve. And in fact, they were getting a little bit worse over time, not due to factors about more difficult patients or increased caseloads or anything like that. We're not learning from what we do. So if we had some way, like measurement-based care, to actually know, are we achieving benchmarks? Are we reasonably good therapists? And more important, can we get better at what we do? And that's where Scott Miller and others, including myself, working on this idea of deliberate practice. We know experts in every domain, athletes, performing musicians, chess players, even taxi drivers in London who have to know every street in their head. How do they get to be experts? They practice deliberately. And we won't go into what are the components of deliberate practice. But we don't have anything like that in psychotherapy. Okay? We go into a room. Nobody really knows what we do there. Nobody measures the outcome of what we do. And as long as we give CBT, we get paid for it. Right? That's absurd. That's absurd. There is no other profession where your performance is so ignored as psychotherapy. It's amazing.
Why do you think this happens, Bruce?
Well, it's part of our tradition. You know, you talk to therapists about implementing some way to improve, and they go, "You're impinging on my autonomy." The essence of psychotherapy is autonomy, okay? And, you know, it's interesting because mandating a particular treatment because it's evidence-based is the biggest violation of autonomy ever, okay? But somehow it's not, you know, that's not the issue there, but it is in terms of measurement-based care, okay? This is just another thing you're imposing on me. Now, you got to do measurement-based care in a really careful and important ways to make it effective. You can't just say, hey, use an instrument, measure your progress, and make an effort to get better. It's a little more involved than that. But come on, we've got to measure outcomes. You know, one of the first studies in the early 90s, we looked at the outcomes of hundreds of therapists. And it was both inspiring, because there were some amazing therapists that helped a variety of patients, young, old, youth, severe disorders, moderate disorders. They were good with everybody. But there were also therapists in that database who never helped a patient. Every single one of their patients deteriorated. That's where the kind of gold is if we want to improve psychotherapy. We've got to look at the outcomes that we produce. And that's part of, you know, psychoanalytic tradition was nobody knows that this therapist is making progress. But me, the wise old psychoanalyst, you can't see what I'm doing, but trust me, I know whether this patient has mined their psyche sufficiently to live a good life. And it was that autonomy. You know, we're not as bad as psychoanalysts, but we're not very good at examining what we do. So anytime. Just give some measures of progress, and let's work to improve rather than me telling you what kind of treatment you have to use. And, you know, good therapists will check the box, I'm doing CBT, and do pretty much what they want to do. That's the way it works. In Australia, you have to check CBT. We really have to know if the therapists are reasonably effective and help them improve. Oh, I know what I was going to say. The biggest place we have to intervene is in the training models. Okay. We have to get away from this idea that we can train therapists by following manuals. That's not the essence of therapy. Yes, they have to learn different protocols. Okay. But you have to be able to do this in an effective way.
Well, first, do you think you have, I don't know, an advice for therapists who are just starting and there are a lot of approaches, a lot of, I don't know, workshops they can attend to? What kind of advice would you give if I don't know, a new therapist asks you?
Well, one advice I would give is don't go to workshops promoting a particular therapy. Okay. You come back all excited. Oh, yeah, now I'm a better therapist. I learned a new treatment. You know, John Norcross, whenever I don't know the answer to something, I ask John because John's a wealth of information. John, you keep track. How many therapies are there? He said, Bruce, about 10 years ago, there were 621. But why in the hell should I keep counting? Okay, so you could go to 621 workshops and learn a new treatment. And, you know, some of them have advanced levels and you all this kind of stuff. Work on what makes you a good therapist. It is a bit harder, okay? But, you know, this idea of deliberate practice is hard work. And nobody really wants to spend the time to do it. But if you look at football players or volleyball players, chess masters, they all really work hard to get better each and every day. You know, one of my favorite quotes is, they asked Pablo Casals, the famous cellist, when he was in his 80s, why do you practice 3 or 4 hours a day? You're the best cellist in the world. And he just kind of says deadpan, I think I'm getting better. And that's what it takes. You know, we think just seeing patients will make us a better therapist. It's not going to. You actually have to work at it.
Yeah, that's a great advice. And in the notes, we are going to also provide some links to episodes of the Making Therapy Better podcast that you can find more about the deliberate practice and also what makes therapy work. It's a great conversation that Bruce had with Scott Miller, and you can learn more about that. And I know that we are close to our time here. And Bruce, I want to ask you, as we look ahead in the field, what do you think psychotherapy and psychotherapists should be more concerned about?
Going into the future. Well, you know, there isn't a workshop I do where I don't get asked about internet therapy, AI bots. We really have to think how to use social media, artificial intelligence, in a way that's going to improve therapy. Otherwise, we're just going to get run over. Okay. You know, psychotherapy's been around for 130 years. There's nothing says that we're not going to get run over and displaced. So we have to really emphasize what we do really well. And how to use. We can't just say, you know, it's the interpersonal relationship of if you don't sit with me in a room, you're not going to get better. There's lots of ways people change. So let's use AI and the technologies in a way that's actually helpful. And there's some people who are doing some pretty innovative things. And then there's some kind of for-profit businesses that are just going to make psychotherapy a commodity, and it won't matter really much about what we do. So, critical time, I think, for us.
Yeah, it really is. And we really appreciate your time and your willingness to be here with us, sharing much of your work and your experience. Thank you so much for everything that you have been doing to the field. And I hope that everyone that is listening to this episode today can learn more about psychotherapy and everything that is making psychotherapy better over time. And don't forget to check out also the Making Therapy Better podcast that Bruce Wampold is the host. And we have great conversations happening there too. So thank you, Bruce. It was really meaningful for us to have you here today.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's been a great discussion. Lots of interesting ideas.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thanks.
And as always, today's podcast was brought to you by CarePaths EHR. Are you a clinical supervisor or do you run a training clinic? CarePaths is a comprehensive electronic health record system built with you in mind. Research shows that therapists get better outcomes and improve more over the course of their careers when they regularly measure their clients' treatment progress and experiences in therapy and then discuss those measures collaboratively. Along with a host of other features, CarePaths makes it easy for therapists to integrate measurement-based care into their practice with just a few clicks. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about our EHR system designed with training clinics in mind, and join us on the path toward making therapy better. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. We hope to see you next time.